Good afternoon. Calling the State Affairs Committee at order at 3:19 in the Max Grunberg Room. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuck? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wold? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Chair Kreisky-Dominick?
Here. And let the record reflect Representative Tuck joined us 5 seconds after roll. Representative Wohl is presenting a bill on finance right now, and we expect he'll be joining us after that. There are three items on today's agenda. HJR 26 is a first hearing from Representative Guerra, a hearing on independent expenditures from Department of Revenue and Legislative Finance, and finally a confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee from the Department of Administration. And we will rearrange the agenda and make the third item second and the second item third to accommodate schedules. Representative Guerra is with us until 3:45 when I believe he has a bill hearing or something,
subcommittee
hearing. So we'll get right to it. Representative Guerra, please put yourself on the record and introduce HJR 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Les Guerra, District 20, and my aide, Tristan Walsh. HJR 26, which actually I think we've given you a CS for to correct some problems in the original bill, is our effort to try and get politics out of the role of redistricting every 10 years, I guess what people commonly call gerrymandering. Roughly 10 states, almost 10 states, have gone the way of trying to find a nonpartisan way to draw district lines so that lines aren't drawn in favor of one party or the other, and I don't think either party has a monopoly on trying to take advantage of the redistricting process in the other states where they don't have nonpartisan processes. I'm going to rather briefly, because we have an expert on the line, Professor Levitt from Loyola University, who works on redistricting and is an expert in the area. So I'll present basically the bill. I don't know if your intent is maybe to adopt the committee substitute for as a working document, because I was planning on speaking to that, but at your discretion, obviously.
Representative Guerra, we can entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute, which we have as a working document, perhaps after the presentation, if that suits you.
Sure, and then I can explain the changes if you did that, however you want me to do it.
Let's hear from Professor Levitt first, and then we can go from there.
Sure. Mr. Chair, then, why don't you hear from Professor Levitt, and then I'll go through the bill after you hear from Professor Levitt. Thank you.
Sounds good. Professor Levitt, if you can hear us, can you please put yourself on the record and present your invited testimony?
I can indeed. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me all right?
Loud and clear.
Excellent. Perfect. My name is Justin Levitt, and I am very grateful for the opportunity to testify before you today and for the courtesy of being able to appear by telephone. I'll take just about 10 minutes if I can, and then hopefully that will transition either into any questions you may have or statement from Representative Guerra to more precisely lay out the bill under consideration. I'm a tenured professor of constitutional law and the associate dean for research at Loyola Law School, Los Angeles. And my scholarship is focused mostly on the law of democracy, including voting rights in particular. I've had the opportunity to pursue research cited to the courts and by the courts, including a testimony I've given to the courts as an expert witness. I also maintain a website attempting to follow and explain the redistricting process and related litigation across the country. And I understand that some materials from that site may have been introduced into the documentary record in connection with this hearing. Also, I should note that my work in the redistricting area is not only theoretical. I just recently returned to Loyola from helping to lead the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, where I had the really profound privilege to supervise and support the federal government's work on, among other things, redistricting. So, both in that role and in prior work, I've had the privilege to seek voting rights for clients and for constituents, and I've also had the privilege to advise and occasionally represent elected officials and election officials of both major parties and neither major party and those whose partisan affiliation I simply do not know. And I will echo the comments that I heard Representative Guerra make Certainly in the realm of redistricting, I don't think either party has a monopoly on abusing the process when they can. And I'm delighted in that context to assist as best I can in your consideration of HDR 26 today. A bit of national context, if I may help put the bill and Alaska's process in perspective. In most states, as you know, sitting legislators draw both their own district lines and, where applicable, districts of members of Congress. And as a pragmatic matter, it's really often legislative leadership that wields this power, not many legislators swinging rank and file seats. And in many states, leadership is at least sorely tempted to use this redistricting power as a cudgel, frankly, against both members of an opposing party and occasionally against members of their own party. The process is very rarely transparent, and because redistricting, when it's pursued as an exercise in raw partisan power, can be so very personal, or appear to be very personal, it often appears to be overflowing with ill will that creates significant conflict among legislators that often carries over well into the several legislative sessions that follow. A process like this, perhaps it's not surprising, breeds substantial cynicism among the public. Even when a process like this doesn't actually put personal and partisan interest ahead of the public interest, in my experience and in the experience of many, many other commentators, it often appears to the public eye as if the system is rigged, with members exercising the power granted to the state to act on behalf of all its constituents, but exercising that power in order to benefit just a few. We are the only industrialized Western democracy of which I'm aware that in most states allows those with the greatest potential for conflict of interest to draw their own electoral district lines. Country after country after country after country has seen what we do and decided that they can find a better way. And a few states, to their credit, Alaska to be commended for its place among them, have also taken an approach different from the one I just laid out. When it comes to drawing state legislative districts, there's more of this. More states have taken a different approach. Two states, Connecticut and Maine, allow the legislature to draw the lines but have supermajority requirements. And those supermajority requirements tend to increase the likelihood of a more bipartisan outcome than you may find elsewhere. Seven states, Arkansas, Colorado, Hawaii, Missouri, New Jersey, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And you'll note a fair amount of political and partisan variation among those states. Those seven states have, instead of the legislature, have established commissions to draw the lines, but allow elected officials to serve on those commissions. In most instances, those bodies are also structured in a manner designed to be bipartisan, so it's different from the legislature as a whole, but allow elected officials to serve on the commissions. In two other states, Iowa and New York, most recently New York, there are advisory bodies with a substantial amount of independence from the legislature, but they're at least theoretically subject to a legislative override. New York's system is new for 2020. We'll get to see how it works for the first time in this redistricting cycle coming up. But Iowa's experience over the last four decades shows that its independent body actually substantially drives the process and has never been, in the final estimation, overridden by the legislature, even though the legislature has that authority. And then there are a few other states, Arizona, California, Idaho, Montana, Washington, and as of 1998, Alaska, that have asked commissions with substantial amounts of independence from the legislature itself to draw legislative lines. And these states, Alaska often included, are often considered among the leaders in establishing redistricting processes that correspond more to the public interest than to partisan or private interest. Members of the commissions in all of these states may not be current sitting state legislators or other specified public officials. The list varies from state to state a bit. And members of the commissions in these states are precluded from running for office in the lines that they draw, at least for a few years after those lines are drawn. In the states with these independent commissions, all but one are designed so that the membership of the commission is balanced in a bipartisan fashion. California also, in addition to that, provides specific membership on the commission for those who are affiliated with neither major party. The one state that does not at present have such a directly and intentionally bipartisan structure is Alaska. Now, as you may have gathered, from among the options that I've listed, from among the models that I've listed, states have created a rather diverse array of options to carry out both state legislative and congressional redistricting. And even within the very rough categories I've described, there are substantial variance in how each structure is designed and substantial variance in how each works in practice. Some of the systems work quite well. Some of them work fairly well. Some, I would say, work fairly poorly. Each can likely be improved, sometimes incrementally and sometimes more exponentially. I firmly believe that, in my experience, there is no single correct cookie cutter answer for every state. No magic bullet that can or should be uniformly implemented everywhere in exactly the same way without concern for demography or history or political context. Iowa's system works quite well for Iowa, but it would not work well in California, I believe. California's system works quite well for California, but is unnecessary for Idaho. Idaho's system works quite well for Idaho, but it isn't likely to work well in New York. And again, each system, even when it functions well for its own state, can likely be improved. Turning now to Alaska, the present system certainly has some elements, indeed many elements, to commend it. But it, too, can be improved. I think the process was improved in 1998 when control passed from the governor alone to the current reapportionment board. And I think that HDR 26, and here and throughout the remainder of my remarks, unless I specify otherwise, I'll refer to the what I understand has been proposed as the working draft version of January 31st. That is the version with some of the corrections that Representative Guerin mentioned, even though I understand that's not formally the bill before the committee at the moment. I think that version of HDR 26 would advance the ball further still. At present, Alaska has some safeguards for the public. Those who draw the lines may not be, as you're probably aware, public employees or officials when they're appointed, nor throughout the tenure of their appointment. There's some provision for geographic diversity, one person from each judicial district among the members of the reapportionment board, and there exists substantial transparency in the way that redistricting is conducted, or at least in the way that it has been conducted in the 2000 and 2010 cycle. And at least in theory, appointments to the reapportionment board are to be made without regard to partisan political affiliation. The people on the apportionment board themselves are, at least at present, not supposed to be partisan. But at the moment, 4 out of 5 members of the reapportionment board are themselves appointed by officials who are elected through partisan political office. And it is often the case that just as the design works out, that officials of one political party will do most of the appointing. And in those conditions, where elected officials who have a partisan allegiance do the appointing to the board, even while the text precludes appointment with regard to partisan affiliation, the public may be misled into perceiving that the board itself has a partisan slant. The January 31st draft of HDR 26 would, I think, continue Alaska's hardy tradition of a redistricting body distinct from the legislature, and would continue the tradition of precluding current public employees and officials. But it would add, I think, a welcome measure of incremental independence by precluding former political party operatives and former elected officials from serving on the board. That is, HDR 26 would prevent someone from retiring from the legislature from another elected statewide office and serving on the board the next day. It would also add a measure of partisan balance to the apportionment body itself, with 2 members from each of the major parties and several members from neither. this more closely, I think, approximates the structure of independent commissions in other states, states like Arizona, like Idaho, like Montana, like Washington. And again, you'll notice a fair amount of political and partisan diversity among that group. I think that it would strengthen these measures of incremental independence and incremental balance, I think would strengthen the faith that Alaskans have, would have, in the redistricting process. The January 31st draft also strengthens the redistricting process's focus on criteria that benefit Alaskans, retaining the state's very strong protections for communities of interest so that legislators really know who they're representing, so that is felt and perceived by the public itself. This criterion would still be embodied in the requirement that districts contain relatively integrated socioeconomic areas, but it would add specific language that would preclude drawing a map to unduly favor a party or particular candidate. And that, I think, is important, both for the substance of the map and for the public perception of it. The Alaska Supreme Court has, I know, in the past rather emphatically enforced the redistricting provisions of state law, and I suspect that it would enforce this command as well. And that, too, should give Alaska citizens incremental confidence that the process is designed for them. One final note, and here I'll wrap up my testimony, my prepared remarks at least. I focus throughout on fair process in my testimony today and not particular results. And I think that's really most appropriate. Alaskans are, I know, diverse, with various protected racial and ethnic communities and plentiful citizens who prefer each of the major political parties, and this, I know, is a fierce independent streak. Some citizens who prefer neither. Districts that are drawn through a fair process will inevitably, in any given cycle or in any given election, end up creating some natural advantages for particular candidates. It is impossible to truly remove all of political results from the redistricting process. But a fair process, process that is designed to be independent of those who are running in the lines that are drawn, and a process that is designed to have some natural balance to it. A fair process will, I think, give Alaskans increased confidence that these electoral contests, whatever their outcomes, have not been unfairly tilted. I think HJR 26 brings Alaska's process closer to that ideal, moving, again, in an incrementally positive direction. I commend you for your work on the resolution, for your work on the issue, and I look forward to assisting you in your deliberative process as best I possibly can. And with that, I'll say those are my prepared remarks. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I would be more than happy to answer any questions you have either now or after Representative Guerra's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Levitt, and we are going to be on a time budget and looking to move to the next item on today's agenda, 345 or 350. So I think with remaining time, there is a motion to adopt the CS as a working document. I know Representative Guerra, you have some remarks, and there's one other invited testifier, Ms. Waring, in the audience with the League of Women Voters. Representative Guerra, do you have a preference how we approach those three?
Through the chair, I could read through the changes to the CS. That might explain some of the things, if that's your will.
Sure, absolutely. Perhaps we can entertain a motion to, well, let's entertain a motion to adopt the CS, put that on the record, and then go forth.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt 30-LSO155/N as the working document.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the motion to adopt the committee substitute carries. Representative Guerra, summary of changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The changes are, there are six of them. Section 1, lines 6 through 10, that is this language comes out of the state of Hawaii and says the map may not be drawn to unduly favor a political party, and a district may not be drawn to unduly favor a political party or a candidate. That was Professor Levitt liked that language in the state of Hawaii. We looked at it and we felt that was appropriate. Lines 4 through 18 in section 2.
And we'll just see how this goes if there are questions as you go, because that might be easiest. I think Representative Ledoux had a question about that change.
So what's the difference between favoring a political party and unduly favoring a political party?
Through the chair, I think that would be an amendment that I don't think would make a huge amount of difference. So I think the point in the provision is that we don't want to favor a political party.
Just follow up.
I guess I do have an answer to remember why we did that, and I think that's the purpose in Hawaii as well. You will have districts that are Democratic-leaning, Republican-leaning, maybe even Green-leaning or AIP-leaning, just by virtue of the way even a nonpartisan redistricting map is done. Not every district is going to be 50-50. So technically, one district may favor a party, but you don't want to unfairly favor a party. The whole map should be written in a way where it doesn't unduly, unwarrantedly favor a party. One district or another district will, by its nature, be either maybe Democratic leaning or Republican leaning. I think that's why the word unduly is in there.
Follow up.
So would it be fair to say that what this actually means is the map may not be drawn with the goal or the intention of favoring one political party or another?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, the whole map. So the statewide map is aimed to be nonpartisan, recognizing that one district or another may lean one way or another.
But, I mean, I think what you're trying to say is that it may end up that way, but that shouldn't be the intention of how you draw the whole map or even the district map.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's true. Yeah.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Section 2, lines 4 through 8. We had the redistricting board at various points consist of 9 members and 5 members, and in all circumstances it'll be 7 members. It'll be 2 members of the largest party, 2 members of the second largest party, but to reflect the fact that in Alaska most voters are independent, it'll be 3 members who are independent, and they'll be picked by those other 4. So that's a change to have 3 independent members. I think originally it was either 1 or 5. Section 4, lines 6 and 7, we had language that banned political contributions by those appointed to the board. Professor Levitt explained that might cause a constitutional problem. We don't want to cause a constitutional problem with this bill. And I think with the way this bill is written, as the 4 party members agree on 3 independent members, they'll be able to see people's political leanings. So we took that part out of the bill. Section 4, lines 9 through 11. Again, the 4 board members now appoint 3 independent nonpartisan members. Section 4, lines 13 through 21. If the 4 members can't agree to 3 independent members within a certain deadline, and this follows Washington and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, if the 4 members are just deadlocked and can't work together to pick 3 independent members, then you call on the Supreme Court to pick the 3 members. It's not the preferred option, but if the parties can't get their act together, then that's what would happen. Subsection 6, or Section 6, lines 1 through 3, is just conforming language.
Thank you. Questions on the changes? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. So when you say independent, do you mean Alaska Independence Party, or are you referring to just an undeclared nonpartisan?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tuck, the 3 members who are not the members of the 4 major or the 2 major parties are non-party affiliated, so truly not affiliated with any political party.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So Section 4D on page 3. The person who is a member of the redistricting board may never have been elected to office. So, I mean, if they were elected 20 years ago, they wouldn't be allowed to serve on it now?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we did allow local officials to be appointed. Local officials are often nonpartisan in the state, but our history in the state is that state officials largely and federal elected officials largely have been affiliated with one of the parties or the other party. We're certainly open to a change there, but we felt that that statewide elected officials who tend to be party affiliated and state legislative officials who tend to be party affiliated probably we felt should not be on the redistricting board.
Follow up.
I guess, and I'm not quite sure how to put this in question form, that I would follow that reasoning if you're talking about the nonpartisan members. But since the three members, I think it is, they're partisan. I mean, they're supposed to be partisan, the four partisan members. So since they're supposed to be partisan, why wouldn't you let them be partisan?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I guess you would very well could be. If that's a provision the committee wishes to change, I'm fine with it. I like it the way it is, but certainly it's the purview of the committee, because really in the end you'll have your two members from each of the two largest parties picking three independents who will be really the power brokers on this board. And so I guess it really does not matter terribly who those four party members are, because the three independent members are going to be the members who decide the balance, and that's not the most important part of the bill.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee on the changes or the piece of legislation as a whole? Representative Guerra, 346, so I think we can. Oh, Representative Tuck, one more question.
Okay, so on page 2, line 16, where we have three members who are not registered as affiliated with a political party and who have not been registered as affiliated with a political party within the preceding 10 years get selected. So my understanding is, as I read this, it doesn't preclude someone who's only been a registered voter for 5 years who've never registered with the party. They can still have the ability to serve.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, yes, there is a requirement that folks have to have voted in the last few general elections. So these will be people who have been residents, I suppose. I suppose somebody who's been here for 6 years, as long as they've been independent the whole time, would qualify.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm looking at section 2, where it talks about on line 5 and 6. The members shall be residents of the state and registered voters who voted in each of the previous four general and primary elections. So, for example, if they were selected in 2017, they would have had to have voted in both the primary and the general in 2016 and the primary and general of 2014. And I guess I'm wondering, sometimes the most partisan people in the world are the ones who vote in primaries. So if you're actually trying to eliminate partisanship, why wouldn't you just have people, why would you make voting in a primary mandatory?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that I would welcome a change on the word primary. It works either way for me, because as I said, the way this is going to work is the two Democrats and the two Republicans, they're going to appoint three independents who are going to outnumber them. Those three independents are going to be the power brokers. So your point, I don't think, will affect the outcome of trying to create a nonpartisan redistricting board.
Thank you.
Thank you. I hope we're not making you late. Unless there are other questions, we can move to Ms. Waring's testimony today, and then we'll hold the bill With the committee substitute on the record, unless you have any closing comments, Representative Kara.
No, through the chair, I can go through the reasons for the bill more in detail the next committee hearing, and if we're able to get Professor Levitt, we'll try and have him back depending on his schedule. But I really appreciate the committee giving us the time to get the bill on the record and get the concept on the record, because I think it's an important thing for the state of Alaska.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Warian, please come forward. Put yourself on the record and present your testimony, and in light of today's agenda, ask that maybe not more than 4 or 5 minutes, if possible.
Try my best.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Margo Waring. I'm a Juneau resident, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this bill. The League of Women Voters has long been concerned with reapportionment and redistricting in the United States. I've belonged to the National League of Women Voters Task Force on redistricting and reapportionment for the 3 years since it has been formed, and we have studied how every state arranges its redistricting boards and the ways in which they seek to improve those processes. I have to say that my file folder in my email is almost incomprehensible. There are so many. And we continue to talk daily about these issues. And we've developed the position which is now held by the National League of Women Voters. I'm pleased to support Representative Garrett's efforts to find a fairer way to redistrict Alaska and encourage House members to be supportive. Alaska's redistricting process has always been contentious. Redistricting in our state constitution was originally a function of the governor, as you know. The Constitutional Convention, seeing the problems in other states that they had in reapportionment in a timely and fair manner, selected the governor model. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the rule of one person, one vote. The redistricting maps of 1970, 1980, and 1990 were found by the Alaska Supreme Court to be unconstitutional. In 1998, the legislature initiated and the public narrowly supported the creation of our current five-member redistricting board, in which two members are appointed by the governor, one by the Speaker of the House, one by the Senate President, and one by the Chief Justice, all without, the words are, without regard to political affiliation. These words imply that the board would be nonpartisan. In practice, nonpartisanship was not achieved. The maps of 2000 and 2010 were challenged in court, and parts were found to be unconstitutional. The criteria cited in the Alaska Constitution are that districts be as nearly equal in population and that one Senate district encompass two House districts. The districts are to be compact and contiguous, contain as integrated socioeconomic character as possible, and pay as much attention as possible to local government boundaries and geographical features. The theme of this history, I think, is that Alaskans, aware of the possibilities of partisanship and gerrymandering and desirous of a nonpartisan apportionment of districts, have since statehood favored approaches that are fair, support the one-person, one-vote rule, and do not allow legislators to pick their own voters. Alaska has yet to achieve this goal. I believe that Representative Gara's effort to reach this goal is to be commended. Representative Gara has made the effort to study the variety of approaches and to select one that can work for Alaska to provide the kind of fairer redistricting process consistent with the concept of one person, one vote, and that Alaskans believe should happen where voters select legislators rather than legislators selecting voters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Waring. With that, I think we will hold the bill. Appreciate your time. And bring it back at a future hearing. And thank you, Mr. Walsh, also for joining us today. Representative, quick question.
I'm just wondering if Ms. Waring will be available at next meeting for questions in regards to this bill. Is her intent to invite her back?
Yeah, absolutely. And Ms. Waring, we'll make sure that you're aware when the next hearing is scheduled. That takes us to the second, formerly the third item on today's agenda, confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee Rydell. And please come forward. And I'd say go ahead, put yourself on the record, and present any comments that might be helpful for the committee. Not that you're a stranger in this room by any means.
I'm not going to run a slideshow today of my life. I actually thought about doing that for fun, but. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having me here today. Like you said, I think I know many of you, or most of you, pretty well. I was in front of you about 55 times last session, so I feel like we got to know each other. And I've had the chance to go around and visit all of you this session, too, so and to welcome you back. I do know some of you personally, and some of you, like I said, I met through work, but I would like to just tell you a little bit about my background. I know you have my resume, just to tell you the backstory of Leslie Rydell. I grew up in Douglas, and I live right now about a quarter of a mile from where I grew up, and it's a great place to grow up in Juneau and Douglas. Although if you've lived here long, you know that Douglas is not Juneau, so I will just put that on the record that I grew up in Douglas. I moved to Anchorage in ninth grade and went to high school up there, and then went off to college at Oregon State, where I went on a student loan from the state of Alaska. Back in the day, they used to give 50% off to students to come back to Alaska if you came back and lived here. So all my friends and I came back because it was such a great program, and we all stayed. And so once you're here, back 1 year, you're here forever, I think. And so unfortunately, that program's gone, but it was a great way to get a bunch of us back home. I then started my real career of teaching, and I taught 8th grade and 7th grade for 6 years at Greening Middle School. I taught 7th grade for one horrible year and 8th grade for 6 lovely years. I say that because 7th grade just didn't work for me, but 8th grade was awesome. I taught English and social studies, and when I was in my late 20s, I decided to come down to Juneau for a year because I wanted to see social studies in action. I wanted to see government in action. So I worked for the legislature, and I actually loved it. As you might guess, I stayed down here and have been back and forth in this world for about 27 years. For that 1 year, I stayed 27 years. And I worked for the House for a couple years. I worked for the Senate for a couple years. I then moved on and worked for Governor Knowles for 8 years. And I worked for Mayor Mark Begich in the mayor's office in Anchorage for a couple years. And then Senator Begich in D.C. and now Governor Walker here. So I've sort of done all sorts of levels of government and two branches of government. I'm not sure I'll ever make it to the court system. But I feel like that background has given me a broad spectrum of experience that has actually served me well in my current position now. I often see things from a different way, I think, just because of that background of the different levels of government. So I started this job with Sheldon Fisher. You know, he was the commissioner, and I actually really valued that time with Sheldon. He taught me a ton, and I'm glad he's only upstairs from me right now. I often still think, what would Sheldon do, or how I call him up and ask him for advice, and we meet as often as we can to go over things as I'm still trying to learn things about the department. So I'm really proud to have worked for him and worked under him and learned a lot from him. So I also looked back when I had to come up for this committee hearing to talk about what we're doing. I looked back at what he and I and our other staff worked on and said that we were going to work on in the 4 years, looking at the chunk of 4 years we are here. And we're still, I feel like I'm finishing up or really moving the projects forward that we got started together, and it's my role to get them really solid here. Like I said, I look at life in 4 year chunks in my career, the way it's gone. So a couple of the things we've been working on: consolidating IT, creating a streamlined system through shared services for the backroom offices of stuff for the state, negotiating fair contracts for our employees, reducing procurement and streamlining it, and also getting it put into a system that we could actually track it better. We had 15 different procurement systems out there, and getting them put together in our state accounting system, IRIS, so we could track things that we're buying. Space utilization, in my budget, you guys all heard we wanted to cut $1 million this year because we have been consolidating our space and we're continuing that. Expanding our customer service for our outward departments like the DMV and retirement and benefits. And then saving money on health care, both for the retiree and the active plan, and looking at the HCA, the health care authority possibility, seeing if that will help us save money. So those are all big initiatives, and then there's lots of other things in between that we work on every day. But We are, I would say those were babies last year, or they're toddlers this year, and I hope to have them to be middle schoolers by the end of this year so that they're ready to really head out in the world, maybe high schoolers, head out in the world and be solid projects in our department. So that's the basics. I'll throw it open if you have questions for me, and let me know if I left anything out.
Questions from the committee? Well, I have a comment. I had no idea of your educational background, and just another feather in your varied cap.
Chair, often when people find out I was a former teacher, they go, oh, it makes sense now, because I'm always bossy and, you know.
Well, one of the
my staff will tell you that, for sure. And always correcting everybody's grammar.
Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, just a comment here, and it's that I hope will be easier on you this go around than we were with the Real ID.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. I try to suppress that into the deep recesses of my memory. Any other comments, Representative Knopp?
I was just surprised. One of the dudes had brought that Real ID thing up, so no.
Let's forget about all that.
Further committee comments? I would just say thank you for your service to Alaska and all these capacities in all layers of government, from teaching our children to local government to state government to federal government. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a good career.
Yeah.
It's not over.
No. hopefully for a while more. Seeing no further committee comment, Vice Chair Ledoux?
I move that Leslie Rydell's name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Thank you. So much.
All right, and the paperwork will circulate as we keep going. Thank you very much. And perhaps relevant to Commissioner Rydell, the next presentation perhaps relates to hopefully helping Department of Administration and in general state government finding efficiencies and trimming any indirect expenditures. And so with that, we'll move to the last item on today's agenda from Department of Revenue and Ledge Finance, Dan Stickle, Kai Clark, and please come forward, and I think maybe we'll start with Department of Revenue, if that works for you all. And we've got
a couple
of PowerPoints, and while we get that set up, and at Representative Ledoux's request, we'll take a brief at ease.
Am I supposed to document about this PowerPoint?
All right, I think we're queued up. Sure looks at Mr. Stickle, Mr. Clark, please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue.
And for the record, Kai Clark, Economist with the Department of Revenue.
So, Mr. Chairman, we were asked to give an overview of our indirect expenditure report, similar to what we presented to the Finance Committees last year, just as a high-level overview of what an indirect expenditure is and the report that we publish for the committee's benefit. So I'm going to let Mr. Clark give most of the presentation, and I think I'm going to chime in at the end.
And actually, I'm going to interject really quickly before you go, Mr. Clark. So this hearing has been some time off, and Representative Knopp and I have talked about this, and I guess just to frame committee members' maybe attention on this subject, including Representative Wohl, who's just joining us, that it's my hope that the information you're presenting, that Alexi also presents, can perhaps inspire committee legislation looking at ways to sort of create greater efficiencies in the statutes that can help us trim down on indirect expenditures and make other changes and do that in a sort of collaborative committee-wide way and actually act on information and recommendations presented. So to the extent that frames how these presentations are absorbed, I hope that's helpful, and thank you again for making yourselves available today.
Sure, and the presentation, as I mentioned, is fairly high level, but we're certainly happy to answer any questions or follow up with the committee on any detail on specific indirect expenditures.
Again, for the record, Kai Clark, economist with the Department of Revenue. As Mr. Stickle mentioned, we're just going to go through the presentation. The overview is the slide that's currently on your screen. We're going to start. I'm going to start by going over the bill provisions and the differences between the DOR, the Department of Revenue Indirect Expenditure Report, and the Legislative Finance Indirect Expenditure Report. We're going to focus on, of course, the Department of Revenue Indirect Expenditure Report. I'll go through the process and methodology behind the production of the report and give a, like Mr. Stickles said, a high-level overview of the report and future plans for the report. So we're on slide four. The legislation behind this report was passed on July 7th, 2014, and it requires the Department of Revenue to submit a report to the legislature biennially every 2 years on July 1st that details all indirect expenditures of all agencies and departments within the state of Alaska. And then it also requires the Legislative Finance Division to provide their report of the indirect expenditures of certain agencies. Theirs is a little bit different, and I'm sure Mr. Painter will go through the differences in their report. The first indirect expenditure report produced by the Department of Revenue, as I said, was in 2014. The first report came out a day after that legislation was passed. The second report was released on July 1st, 2016, and the next one will be released this year on July 1st. Now, what is an indirect expenditure? It's defined in statute. I'll go ahead and read the description here of an indirect expenditure. It's any foregone revenue by the state designed to encourage an activity to benefit the public in the form of a credit, exemption, deduction, deferral, discount, exclusion, or other differential allowance. And as defined by AS 4305-095D, I'll go through each of these and give an example of what each of these is. So the first definition, as I went through and read the actual definition, a tax credit or other credit, an example would be the oil and gas tax credits that we have and you all are familiar with. An exemption, not including federal tax exemptions. An example of that would be within the Department of Administration. They have the motor vehicle license plate and registration fees for disabled persons, and that waives those fees for the beneficiaries. And that's an example of an exemption. A discount within the Department of Environmental Conservation, there's a 50% discount on annual food safety and sanitation permit fees for nonprofit organizations. That's an example of a discount. A deduction, not including costs incurred in the ordinary course of business. An example is within the Department of Revenue, we have the mining license tax. A percentage depletion deduction is allowed for certain types of mining, and that would qualify under this definition of an indirect expenditure of a deduction. That's an example. And the last one, a differential allowance within the Department of Health and Social Services. There's the Pioneer Home Payment Assistance Program, which allows residents to reside in Pioneer homes even though they may not have the full amount of funds to pay the full monthly rate that's charged at the Pioneer home. A differential allowance is allowed for those beneficiaries to be able to participate in that program. So this most recent indirect expenditure report, as I mentioned before, it was released on July 1st, 2016. It details 231 different indirect expenditures across 11 departments and agencies, and 78 of those indirect expenditures are administered by the Department of Revenue. It was truly a cooperative effort between all the departments and agencies involved. We couldn't have completed it without the cooperation and collaboration of all departments and agencies within the state. They provided us with the information that we weren't able to get ourselves. And we followed the process that was established with the first indirect expenditure report, which was published in 2014 with an improved presentation, which included an expanded introduction in the actual report, and other refinements and tweaking methodologies and making those better and more refined. Now, delving into the actual methodology of the report itself, we'll start with what we did in the Department of Revenue. We surveyed all tax division work groups and all divisions within the Department of Revenue to ensure a complete list of all indirect expenditures in the department. We developed tax database reports to query our own system to generate revenue impacts and other information that we included in our indirect expenditure report. And an example of a methodology tweak and something that we had to nail down for our report, we had to develop a consistent definition for fiscal year, given that tax types come in on different schedules. We can receive tax returns on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis. And nailing down a fiscal year definition was important so that we could compare indirect expenditures and be able to nail down a revenue impact for any given fiscal year. An example of this is we receive corporate income tax returns on an annual basis. So, and I think we address this in the next slide here, and we talk about that. Using that example that I just mentioned of corporate income tax, as an example, again, for fiscal year 2015, the definition that we used for fiscal year would include any returns that we received within the fiscal year, with the return beginning with a period beginning in the fiscal year, which would be July 2014 through June 2015. We had to nail down that definition because some returns we wouldn't receive until a year or a year and a half later. So that's just an example of something that we had to nail down methodology-wise. Externally, we met with other departments and agencies, sending out a survey for the report so they could report to us the indirect expenditures that they found within their own departments and agencies. Each agency examined their operations to identify the indirect expenditures. And a few of the departments identified provisions that didn't actually meet the definition of an indirect expenditure. And we have a few examples of those on this next slide, on slide 11. An example from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, they identified a potential indirect expenditure, which was reduced loan rates, but because it was part of their normal operations and not required by statute, these reduced loan rates, statutorily, AHFC, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, can set their own rates, and therefore it didn't meet the definition, the statutory definition of an indirect expenditure, because they could set their own rates.
Question, Representative Tark.
Thank you on that. So once a rate is set and they decide to discount that rate, I guess, for lack of a better term, from one class of people from another class of people, would that then qualify, or is that still not qualified as an independent expenditure?
Sure. For the record, Dan Steckel, Representative Tuck to the chair. According to the statutory definition, and that's part of the reason we want to throw this slide up, is to kind of highlight what gets included versus not included under statute. Under the statutory definition, the differential has to actually be set in statute. So when you give a fee-setting authority, that's an example where an agency might be able to provide a reduction to a fee or a rate, but it doesn't qualify as an indirect expenditure under this reporting requirement.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
Again, for the record, Kai Clark, Department of Revenue. The next example we have here is from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. They have certain licensing fees that are set by statute to cover their program costs. One is reduced for a reduced licensing fee, residents versus non-residents, but it's not determined to be foregone revenue because the fee differential doesn't affect total revenue. And the University of Alaska, they have tuition waivers. They award tuition waivers to employees and their dependents, but because they're part of the employee's benefit package, they're not considered foregone revenue because they're part of what they're providing to an employee. And another example from the University of Alaska, non-resident versus resident tuition. The University of Alaska isn't discounting the resident tuition rate. Rather, they're setting the out-of-state student. They're paying a non-resident surcharge, so there's no foregone revenue there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me just go back to the DCCED one. So I kind of see the two, that and the University of Alaska, kind of similar, but I think it's so one is that we have a reduced fees for residents. So that's looking at a flat fee, but if you're a resident, you get a reduction in fees, which is, I believe, that one is in statute. Is that correct? Through the chair?
Through the chair, yes.
All right, so that is an example where something is written in statute, but we're given a reduction. So I don't understand why that's exempted just off the top. The University of Alaska one, it seems like it's kind of like you have a fee, but then you're charging other people from out of state a higher fee, not really a discount or reduction. So I can see how you can kind of get around it on that one. Could you explain the difference between the two and how the DCCED one isn't lost revenue?
Yeah, and through the chair, Representative Tuck, for the DCCED one, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, because of the definition of an indirect expenditure that's laid out in statute, the program for DCCED, the program is completely funded by the same fees that they're taking in, and under the definition of an indirect expenditure, because they're funding the program with the same fees that they're bringing in, it doesn't meet the definition of an indirect expenditure because it's not foregone revenue. Because they're getting revenue.
Okay, I'll think about that one for a bit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think Representative Ledoux might be continuing those thoughts. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I gotta wonder when I'm looking at the DCCED one, if you're saying that this isn't foregone revenue because of the statutory definition of foregone revenue, when I think most people would kind of view this as foregone revenue. Maybe the statute needs some changing, because it sure as heck seems to me like it's foregone revenue. I mean, I totally don't understand how this could be viewed as not foregone revenue.
Sure. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, Dan Stickle for the record. So what's going on with this Department of Commerce licensing fees is the licensing fees are set in such a manner that they provide all of the revenue needed to administer the program. And so resident fees might be a little lower and non-resident fees might be a little bit higher, but the total revenue received is covering the cost of the program.
Representative Ledoux.
The chair. Well, I guess that's true, that it might cover the cost of the program, but if you had increased fees for the residents, then that might actually cover more than the program. And so if it covered more than the program, then that could be used to decrease the amount of UGF that funds the department. So to me, it's still foregone revenue.
Sure, Representative Ledoux through the chair, and we agree that there's kind of a deficiency in this in the statutory definition here, and that's why we're providing these examples of things that, you know, the legislature may look at these and think that it's a reduced fee that they want to take a look at, but based on our interpretation of the definition of indirect expenditure, this is not included in our book.
And for the purposes of this presentation, I see what Representative Ledoux is saying. I also see what you guys are saying. Like, we just need to cover the cost of the program by hook or by crook, whether there's differential rates or not, it's covering the cost of the program, end of story. But it's, I think, flagged, so we're at least aware of it if there's committee interest. But So at risk of beating the dead horse, or maybe it's not a dead horse, any further questions, Representative Tuck?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So how is that different when we looked at the use example of the Department of Motor Vehicles? Because Department of Motor Vehicles, they have fees that pays for their operations, but then we get additional revenue from that, as Representative Ledoux is pointing out. So how is that different, and this isn't the same?
Sure. Representative Tuck, through the chair, I apologize. I'm not not really prepared to speak to the DMV indirect expenditure right now, but we'll definitely follow up with you
okay.
on that.
Okay. No, thank you.
And,
thank you
and Ledge much. Finance might be able to provide an answer on that one.
Sure.
Later
sounds
on.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Knopp?
So, well, I'm going to thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I want to touch a little bit on what Representative Tuck said. I think the clear difference is you set in statute to raise funds to manage a program as in the licensing fees, but that's not the same case as it is in DMV. We just set fees, but there's not a statutory requirement to only cover the cost of administering the DMV. Would that not be the difference in your definition?
Representative Knopp, through the chair, that sounds plausible, and again, we'll take a closer look and follow up with the committee on that. Again, the goal of this presentation is just to provide a real high-level overview to kind of set the stage and get you guys familiar with the publication that we put out.
Thank you.
Again, for the record, Kai Clark, economist with the Department of Revenue. Moving on, we've gone through each of these examples here on slide 11. Moving to slide 12. These are the pieces of data, the information that are required in statute to be reported for this indirect expenditure report. I'll go through each of them, even though you have them on the slide in front of you. Each department was required to report the name of the indirect expenditure, give a brief description of that indirect expenditure, the statutory authority, the repeal date, if there is a repeal date, the intent of the legislature in enacting the statute that authorizes the indirect expenditure, the public purpose that's served by the indirect expenditure, the estimated revenue impact of the indirect expenditure for the previous five fiscal years, and that excludes the year directly previous to the publication of the report. For example, our latest indirect expenditure report came out on July 1st of 2016, so it would not include any FY 2016 revenue impacts. It would start with 2011, FY 2011, and go through 2015. The estimated cost to administer the indirect expenditure, if applicable again, and the number of beneficiaries who benefit from the indirect expenditure. Along with these pieces of information that are required to be reported within the Department of Revenue and the survey that we developed asking for this information, we also asked for the type of indirect expenditure, those different types we went through before, whether it's a tax credit, an exemption, et cetera, and as well as the year that the indirect expenditure began or was enacted. So when you open the Department of Revenue's indirect expenditure report, first you'll see the introduction, which discusses the purpose of the report, what's included in the report, and an explanation of the limitations of the methodology, as I went through before. And the indirect expenditures are organized within DOR's report as follows: by department alphabetically, by division alphabetically, and then they're grouped by a program name within each division, if applicable. An example would be in the tax division, we have different program groups such as corporate income tax, fisheries taxes, mining taxes. There's some examples of how indirect expenditures will be grouped by their program. And future plans for the Department of Revenue's indirect expenditure report. We have in the past, and we will continue to reach out to the Office of Management and Budget and the Legislative Finance Division to get their opinion of the report and things that we may be able to improve. We've compiled and we continue to compile feedback and suggestions, which will be incorporated into the next report, which will be published this summer, July 1st, 2018. and discussion with the agencies of their ability to provide more information. There were some indirect expenditures that were missing certain things just because it wasn't either available or they couldn't find the information. So we continue to work with them to be able to make the report as complete as possible. With that, I'm going to pass it back to Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle. So when we presented this information last session to the finance committees, they asked us for some recommendations or considerations of what they could take a look at if the legislature wanted to examine some of these indirect expenditures in more detail. So we provided them with five different ideas of areas that you guys could look if you want to take a closer look. On slide 17, in 2015 and 2016, there was a piece of legislation that would have repealed four specific indirect expenditures. That was House Bill 155. And then I know this year there's House Bill 96 that is a similar piece of legislation and repeals a tobacco products, cigarette, and large passenger vessel gambling indirect expenditure. That piece of legislation does not include the motor fuel tax repeal. Another consideration was if you want to save some money, look at where the money's at. So we provided a list of the largest indirect expenditures, starting with oil and gas tax credits, which the legislature's made significant changes to in the years since. Mining license tax depletion deduction, as Kai mentioned, on down through sport fishing senior discounts. So this is a list of the largest indirect expenditures. Some of these are probably quite valid, but in terms of monetary value, it gives you a place to start. And then third, legislative finance in their report, which Mr. Painter is going to talk about in a couple minutes, they actually provide recommendations on what to do about the different indirect expenditures that we look at. So they've actually provided a pretty significant cohort of indirect expenditures that they recommend either be terminated, reconsidered, or reviewed by the legislature. And then finally, this gets a little bit to Representative Tuck's question earlier, is to look at fee setting authority. The legislature has granted fee setting authority to several different agencies or organizations. The Marine Highway Fee Setting Authority and DOT is one example. Some of the tuition authority at University of Alaska is another example, as well as the rate setting authority at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So we don't have a comprehensive list, but this is definitely another area that's not explicitly covered in our report that might be worth taking a look at.
Can I ask a question about fee setting authority? So in the spirit of Representative Tuck and Ledoux's questions about licensing and how per statute licensing fees are supposed to cover the cost of administering those licensing programs, potentially the legislature could, for instance, revisit the statutes and say, okay, now we want you to cover the cost of licenses, but we also want you to cover a prorated cost of all UGF that runs Department of Commerce administration. In other words, cost of the licensing and some to cover the overhead. Would that be an example of, well, would that, I guess, speak to, I think, the idea that I started to hear upwelling from Representative Ledoux and Representative Tuck?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, maybe. I don't want to put my lawyer hat on and say if that's something that you could do. But definitely getting information about where the legislature has granted the fee setting authority to different agencies would be a useful place to start.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
So I actually think this is pretty awesome. I mean, this is going to be a huge undertaking to put all this together in a report. You probably believe that you don't have to do it annually. I'm kind of curious and going back into what was it, House Bill 305, to see what the fiscal note was on that and see if you guys are able to meet that, or House Bill 306, I mean, meet that fiscal note. But no, I look forward to going over the report. And I think I understand a little bit clearer after Representative Knopp had asked his question. It's just basically, and I understand it's what's in statute versus what is the fee schedule. And I think that what we have with Department of Motor Vehicles is probably more in statute than it is them being able to set their own fees. So so I don't feel like you need to answer that, but if you want to answer, you're more than welcome to in the future. But I think I get it.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the end of our presentation, Mr. Chairman. If there's any further questions. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for a great presentation. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if, after kind of pulling this together and compiling this this summary, do you have any recommendations?
Representative Birch, through the chair, I feel like we've, you know, I threw a couple slides at the end here that gave some ideas on different places that you could take a look. My recommendation would be to take a look at those.
Okay. Fair enough. Super. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Really appreciate it. And if you wouldn't mind, stay in the room in case there are questions that come up with Ledge Finance or full committee discussion after. Mr. Painter, please come forward and put yourself on the record and give your presentation.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And to answer, this is a weird chair, to answer the question that came up earlier about the Department of Administration, those fees are not set with any relation to the costs of the program. So if we increase those fees, it wouldn't, we could do that. Whereas if we got rid of an exemption in the fees for a board, according to the current statute, that would just shift who pays. It wouldn't actually result in more revenue to the state unless we change that statute. So it's not really an indirect expenditure, by the way, it's in the way that it's written. However, if the statute were written so that it was any discount that results in reduced payments by an individual or business, then you would see that indirect expenditure show up. And so, you know, it's really just an artifact of how that statute was written at the time. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Legislative Finance Report, which is sort of the follow-up to the Department of Revenue Report. So Department of Revenue does a report every 2 years that covers all of the state agencies that have indirect expenditures. What we do is we take their report and then make recommendations to the legislature based on that data just for some of the agencies. So each report, we have a few agencies we're supposed to look at. And agencies that we covered in 2015, our report comes out at the beginning of session, so it's basically 6 months after the DOR report. There's some that we looked at in 2015 that we haven't revisited. So the data that we were looking at the time, the most recent year is actually FY13, so it's now five-year-old data. So while those old recommendations can perhaps be a useful starting point, we can't say that, you know, 3 years after we originally wrote those recommendations, they still necessarily are valid. We make many references to several references to the federal corporate income tax rate that has changed. So the impact of some of these may be different than when we originally did the report. So in 2015, we covered the Departments of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Fish and Game, Health and Social Services, Labor and Workforce Development, and Department of Revenue. So as DOR already showed you, here's the summary of our recommendations. We recommended terminating 17 provisions, and the total known revenue impact of those was $5 million. There were three provisions of those that the revenue impact was unknown at the time. We recommended modifying or reviewing 59 provisions. There were 37 that we could unequivocally say to continue, and there were 25 that we couldn't make recommendations on. And often that was because the legislature had just instituted them or just changed the statute the year before, so we felt that it was inappropriate for us to say whether this was or wasn't meeting the legislative intent, since it hadn't really been around for very long. Or in a couple of cases, we just had insufficient information. There was an unknown revenue impact at the time. There was an unknown cost to administer. And so we felt like there was really no way we could make any sort of meaningful recommendation. The subsequent report that DOR produced in 2016 filled in a lot of the blanks about those revenue impacts. Given the time frame, the first time, you know, they produced the report the day after the bill was signed, so obviously the turnaround was pretty fast. They were working on it between the time the legislature passed it and the time the governor signed it. There were a lot of unknowns, so when we made our recommendations, we had a lot of blanks that we couldn't really make analyze very well. So from those terminate recommendations, those 17, one of them has actually been repealed in House Bill 247. And as I said, we have revenue estimates for some of the things that we couldn't discuss before. So if you look back at that report and see an unknown revenue impact or no recommendation from us, you know, look at the more recent revenue report. There may actually be more information there.
On this slide, so of the 2015 recommendations, looking at the five agencies I understand that were examined, one of the 17 termination recommendations has been executed, so to speak, by the legislature.
Correct.
Can you give some examples, if you can call them off the top of your head, of the other 16, particularly any of the 16 that fall within the jurisdiction of this committee?
Sure. Well, as I understand, the jurisdiction of this committee is state affairs, so pretty much everything, so I'm not sure what the limitation would be, but many of them are within the corporate income tax. There's a number of that. The main structure of that hasn't really been updated since the maybe 70s. There's been some updates since then, but some of the assumptions that were made at the time probably don't fit with modern tax law or could be done better now, because they were referencing things in the federal tax code that no longer exist. For example, at the time when we put in our corporate income tax, there was a differential between the capital gains tax and regular income in the federal tax code. So for uniformity, we took those percentages and applied them to our own corporate income tax and said, well, we'll tax capital gains at a lower rate based on the percentages that the feds do. They don't do that anymore. So now we have these weird differentials that are based on nothing really at all. They're based on the differentials in the 1970s federal tax code. We would say that probably there's no reason that that particular differential should exist as it is. The legislature should probably at least revisit that issue, since it has been 40-something years since they've done that. There are also several within the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and I do not know much about those, so I probably can't give much more information. That's maybe outside the scope of this committee.
Count me as curious, though.
Okay. Well, it's in the report. Our fiscal analyst for that department, Amanda Ryder, could probably be of much more use. And so of these recommendations, also the House Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Revenue reviewed them last year. I think at least one or two of you are on that committee, and they went pretty much line by line through all of the recommendations and recommended modification, repeal, or further review of 17 of the provisions in the Department of Revenue. They're not the same 17 necessarily as the ones that we recommended termination of, but there's a lot of overlap. So in 2017, we covered more agencies but fewer indirect expenditures, because the largest chunk of them are in the Department of Revenue. So in 2017, we covered administration, education, and early development. That included the Student Loan Corporation and the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Department of Environmental Conservation, Natural Resources, Transportation, and the Judiciary. Plus, we also added a review of the education tax credit, because it is scheduled to sunset at the end of this calendar year. So since in our 2015 report, the legislature had modified that credit the previous year, we didn't feel like we could really analyze it at that point because the modified credit didn't have any new data for. So we did a full analysis of that in this report. And if you look at the 2017 Ledge Finance Report, there's one section for the Department of Revenue that covers that and makes some recommendations to modification of that statute. And a bill is, I believe, in the Education Committee currently that does not just extends the bill, does not actually incorporate our recommendations. So in the 2017 report, we recommended termination of two provisions. Neither of them had a known revenue impact. We recommended the modification or review of 13 provisions, the continuation of 56, and no recommendation on 6. So you notice that these ones are very different split. There are much more, many more that were discontinued. That's because of the agencies that we were reviewing. Most of these were things like in the Department of Administration, there's reduced fees if you're a disabled veteran or a senior, things like that. We pretty much recommended those continue. There were not as many substantive recommendations in this report as in the first one. So part of the reason of that is that there's some of these provisions, revenue generation is not the goal of the fee. And the biggest example of that is that when you get a ticket from the court system, a lot of the time you will be able to get that ticket waived if you correct the action. And that shows up as an indirect expenditure because it's foregone revenue by the state. But the goal of giving you a ticket is really to get you to correct that action. So while it is foregone revenue, that is fulfilling the purpose. So we recommended those continue. For example, if you have a broken taillight, the point of giving you a fine isn't to get the revenue, it's to have you fix your taillight. And others, they have their authority to set the fee structure, and we talked about this a bit in the previous one. With the Marine Highway, they've reported all of their fee differences in this report, but they don't actually, the legislature does not actually have the authority to set their fee structure unless we change their statute. We delegated that authority to them. So unless we're willing to change that statute, there's not really much we can do. And so there's a bit of an inconsistency that if departments want to provide information, they can, even if they don't technically qualify as an indirect expenditure, but they're not forced to. So the provisions that were in DEC and DNR were actually reviewed. Oh, looks like there's a question.
Representative Ledoux.
Let's go back to what you just said about departments don't have to provide data. Mm-hmm. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the statute says that they shall submit data to the Department of Revenue, but there's no punishment for not doing so. So when the university is an example of that, I think as we talked about, some of their tuition discounts maybe are on the border of whether they qualify or not, and they chose not to participate, saying that they don't really qualify. And so if they fell on that other side of the line, you know, Department of Revenue doesn't have any authority over the university. They can't force the university to do something if they don't want to. So there's not really a way we can do that other than that the legislature, if we want an agency to participate and they're not, we can tell them that they should.
Well, I guess the legislature, follow up, I guess the legislature said shall, which is kind of a mandatory word. Could you please provide us with a list of all of the departments and agencies who interpreted shall to mean, well, we can if we want to and we can't if we don't want to?
With the chair, Representative Ledoux, no agencies have actually had identified indirect expenditures and declined to participate at this point. So there's no agencies that are just out of compliance with this. And if they were, that would be one of the things that our Ledge Finance Report would highlight. But at this point, they are not. Their university has a valid reason for why they don't participate.
I follow up.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm still confused. I mean, if you've asked for the data and the statute says shall, and they haven't provided the data, why aren't they out of compliance?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, they did not provide the data in the university's case because they said that they don't meet the statutory requirement, which is correct.
Isn't that a little bit like telling the IRS when they want to audit you that you don't have to provide the data because you're not out of compliance with the tax laws?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think the difference is that the agencies determine what's an indirect expenditure and what is not. So if they determine that they do not have indirect expenditures under the statute, then that is the binding interpretation. If the legislature wishes that the university would participate, you should change the statute to address the university's concerns. And from conversations with the sponsor of the original bill, they did appear to intend that some of these would participate, but did not write the statute in a way that seems to have accomplished this. So a statutory change would probably be the best way to address that.
Maybe that's a committee bill.
Thank you.
Okay, continuing on. So the DEC and DNR House subcommittees last year reviewed their indirect expenditures. Some of them we had recommended review in our report. They did review them and found that some of the ones that we recommended be reviewed were there for good reason. For example, in DEC, there were some fee exemptions where if we tried to charge a fee, the process of setting that fee and actually collecting it would cost more than that fee would generate. So leaving that fee exemption made sense. So in those cases, they reviewed them and did not recommend any statutory changes, unlike the DOR review.
Representative Ledoux.
So am I hearing correctly that DEC and DNR, that the cost for eliminating an exemption would be more than it would be to just leave it alone?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. So the one in question was in the Department of Environmental Conservation. There are fee exemptions for there are only 125 such facilities in Alaska, and a reasonable fee that could be charged for the inspections that they receive would be in the order of, you know, maybe $100 a facility. I'm just throwing out a number. The amount of revenue that would generate would be $12,000. So going through a fee study, which requires regulation changes, would not be worth it for $12,000. So it's just too small of a group to go through that process. That was the determination of the subcommittee. And I think Representative Johnson was on that subcommittee.
Representative Ledoux, do you have a follow-up before we go to Representative Johnson?
I guess if you're looking at it at, you know, the one particular year, I can follow that. But it would generate, like, over 10 years, 120,000 or something like that. So,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, on right now, I believe it was in State Affairs. No, not exactly sure where I heard this at, but we have a request to change the rules on the DEC spill. Charges to residents that aren't businesses. So I was just wondering. Now, would that go in? That would go into the end. Now, would that be considered an indirect? If that passes, would that be considered an indirect expenditure?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I believe that's in House Resources, and I have not reviewed that bill because. My understanding is, yes, it would be an indirect expenditure because we would be saying that if your spill is below a certain amount, or then you get charged no fee, whereas others are. So that would be a one fall into the category of indirect expenditure. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. So next year we have another report coming up, and from the way the statute is written, we have no agencies to review. It provided certain agencies that we'd review in each of the first 2 years and said that in the third year we would review all the agencies that were left. There were no agencies left that reported indirect expenditures. So rather than submit to you a blank report, we will submit a report that reviews the two tax credits that are scheduled to sunset, the Community Development Quota Tax Credit and the Salmon and Herring Product Development Tax Credit. So that will be the entirety of our report per the statute. And that is all I have. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
Questions from the committee? Representative Tuck.
Would you by any chance remember, through the chair, the fiscal note on House Bill 306?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I do not know the exact numbers. However, I probably should not speculate because this is my hazy memory of something that happened 4 years ago, but I believe it gave Department of Revenue 3 positions and was later in the supplemental budget reduced to 1 position. So the ongoing, I don't remember the dollar amounts, but I do remember that the ongoing cost was 1 position. The Legislative Finance Division was also given a small amount for contractual services and ended up using that to hire me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Really appreciate your time and the information. This is a subject I hope we can revisit and also drill down to specific indirect expenditures in different agencies relevant to this committee. Arguably pretty fiscally imperative these days. Seeing no other questions and there being no other business or items on the agenda today, thanks Max and Martha for facilitating today's meeting. And I do actually, importantly, do want to note that at this time, unless you hear otherwise, it's my intention to bring HB 152 before the committee on Thursday. And for members not present, I will trust staff to convey this word to absent members and potentially have committee action on the bill at that time. So we're adjourned and we'll reconvene Thursday at 3:15 p.m.